thank you for pausing during your busy day to enjoy tea with Crystal, a glimpse inside a storyteller's mind. This podcast is brought to you by the Purple Prose Room and Harry Buns Productions, written, narrated, and produced by Crystal Rady Young, author of the book series Fates Champions and Tea with Friends Cookbook. Copyright 2021. Good morning, prosers. Welcome to episode 9. Pardon my big sigh. Now that the weather is hot, it's iced tea season in Texas. Alas, cold isn't good for the vocal cords. For now, I'll just have to settle for a bit of fire and ice with some hot peppermint tea. Considering it's a twofer, I believe it ties in nicely with today's topic. To be or not to be. Extra. For a little while in 2019 and early 2020, I wrote a blog called Confessions of a Middle-Aged Writer. I'll be honest here. I was kind of doing it under duress. I had done two previous blogs simultaneously for fun, from 2012 to 2018. They did a lot to knock the rust off the writing gears, but by the time the last post made its appearance, I was pretty much over it. Still, I did manage to get a few posts from blog number 3 that I really enjoyed writing. One of my favorites was written during the last week of December 2019, called The Year of Being Extra. If only I knew then. Hold on there, I can guess what you're thinking. I would have still written it, just a bit differently. 2020 was a year people needed to step up and be extra, and 2021 didn't start off much better. There's been plenty of extra going on, and often not in a good way. One painful lesson which smacked many butts was the realization it's not a good idea to take too much for granted. Many historical precedents are there to remind us, including one we discussed not too long ago. Remember the Titanic? I'm certain its first-class accommodations were beyond extra. And where are they now? Sitting 12,000 feet below the Atlantic Ocean surface. I'm going to get brave here and point out this very human tendency has been the downfall of every empire which has ever existed. Those with a bit of money in their pockets get used to having easy access to both their wants and needs. Not to mention, they've been conditioned that it's someone else's job to fix nasty little problems, when they do dare to raise their heads. For a short time after the pandemic spread like wildfire, no one was laughing at preppers anymore. They were too busy hoarding everything they could find on store shelves, including toilet paper. It takes time for the cavalry to arrive, my friends. Especially when they waste time arguing over how to get the job done first. Our family has lived through at least 3 natural disasters related to tropical storms since we moved to Texas, and we've been through many power outages, including one which lasted for 3 weeks after Hurricane Ike in 2008. We know better than to wait until the last minute to prepare for a disaster. It's a nice feeling to know we not only have necessities already on hand. One of the first things we do after entering survival mode is to consume any perishable goods which might spoil before utilities are restored. This includes goodies purchased for special occasions, while they were on sale. Basically, while everyone else is freaking out about low provisions, we treat ourselves to a steak dinner. Here's the truth of the matter. Smaller tribes are far more efficient at getting things done. They mobilize quickly by maintaining a constant state of readiness, and have the ability to travel quickly, if they're not already in an area. It's the biggest reason military special forces and exploratory groups throughout history have operated with small numbers of personnel and equipment. What exploratory groups, you're asking? Well, besides all those small tribes who first spread from Africa, how about a few Polynesians and Vikings? My daughters occasionally have the nerve to call me extra. Naturally, when they do, it's not a compliment, but more of a deadly insult. I know I'm extra, and it doesn't bother me. I not only came that way, I had the privilege of growing up with older relatives from a rural background, who were either born before and served in World War I, or were born shortly after, survived a depression and Midwest Dust Bowl, then entered young adulthood during World War II. Talk about some folks who knew how to fend for themselves. None of them had electricity in their homes growing up. Even both of my parents and an uncle, who were born in the mid-40s and early 50s, remembered living in homes that didn't have an indoor toilet. In the case of my mom and uncle, one of those houses was owned by my grandfather's railroad employer. Think about this for a moment. During this time period, do you think the owners of the railroad company were living in houses without electricity or indoor plumbing? When the rural areas finally caught up to the wealthy folks in urban areas, most of my people never entirely gave up the skills necessary to their youthful survival. In fact, retaining them was not only a point of pride. They gained personal satisfaction from continuing to be both productive and self-sufficient whenever possible. Many of the old-school interests I have were either taught by them or I remembered watching them and taught myself later. Many of my older female relatives, both grandmothers and great-aunts, had skills we consider strictly hobbies now, including cooking. If my grandmothers are still alive, I imagine they would have an opinion or two on home meal delivery services. I'm not opposed to giving myself an occasional break or even a treat, but it does make me sad to see a television commercial of a couple enjoying one of those pre-made meals and celebrating that they don't have to cook anymore. If you're paying close attention, you will notice they don't seem to have children yet. Memories around food are not only some of the earliest we stash in our mental banks, they are also some of the most precious. How many celebrity chefs claim their chosen career path resulted from time spent in the kitchen with their mothers and grandmothers? Do we really want to rob current and future generations of something so critical to the family bonding process? Not to mention, it puts people even one step further away from understanding the origins of their food and the ability to sustain themselves when the trappings of civilization suddenly disappear. You can't teach and pass on a fundamental skill if you don't know how to do it. I know being considered a foodie has been rather popular for a while. In fact, for the whole of human history. My grandmothers and their sisters were farm and ranch girls of big pioneer families, from the Scandinavian countries and what is now known as Germany. They were a bit different in some respects, that at least one each of their parents actually came from well-to-do families in Europe. But here in the United States, they were like all their neighbors, none of whom were rich or ate fancy things on a daily basis. They did still break out the celebration food for special visitors, not seen very frequently, in the holidays. Anyone coming to their houses for dinner definitely had something for which to look forward. However, I spent enough time with my grandparents the remainder of the year that I ate many simple everyday meals with them, the kind you often throw together without the benefit of a recipe. They are still my favorites, and I make them too, sometimes with my own little twist. My paternal grandmother opened and ran her own upholstery shop when I was in elementary school. I don't remember how old I was at the time. Out of 9 grandchildren, I was number 8. So grandma would have been a decade or less from retirement age. I loved her shop. It fascinated me to watch her turn someone's tired, ratty furniture into something new and elegant. Her shelves full of fabric bolts and boxes of scraps kept me entertained for hours. It felt like I explored a cave of wonders. All the shop's inventory cost money, and she wasted as little as possible. Leftover fabrics and stuffing became smaller projects like accent pillows. And at Christmas one year, all the grandchildren found teddy bears waiting under the tree. She allowed us to choose, one at a time, from oldest to youngest. It turned out there was one extra bear, smaller than the others with dangly legs. The moment I saw it, that was the bear I wanted. Being second to youngest, I sat on pins and needles, hoping desperately no one chose before my turn. I needn't have worried. No one else coveted the small bear. By the way, I still own it, though it is in need of a few repairs now. Perhaps all my youthful inspiration explains my love of multipurpose projects. Not to mention, when you've learned something useful, you're obligated to pass it on to the next generation. Humanity wouldn't have lasted for thousands of years otherwise. Our daughters used to protest the concept of making and growing things when they could easily be purchased. Now, they've lived long enough to see the value in retaining a few skills. They enjoy the satisfaction of producing instead of just consuming. Hey, what can you say? They come by their own little bit of extra, honestly. Now that a bit of history has been addressed, I'll gleefully take a poke at the saying, Jack of all trades, master of none. Someone brought up this topic in the comments of another blog I followed, and dropped me into this rabbit hole. I graciously grant them the credit for inspiring the year of being extra post in 2019. Sure, I somewhat resemble this saying, but it really steams my clams. This whole Jack thing is an inherited trait. It might also be due to the fact my birthday is either on the last day of summer or the first day of fall, and I miss being a Libra by one day. Virgo and Libra do share some traits, most especially a love of organization and practicality. They're also both creative thinkers, only Libras are somewhat less bashful. I've never liked anyone telling me, no, you can't do that. Even if I never said it out loud, my first response has always been, who's going to stop me? And I can promise neither you or your army isn't big enough. Hippie rebel with a cause, born in the late 1960s, on a day of transitions. It's all starting to make sense now. Thank goodness for the practical streak. It probably kept me out of jail. Although I can't make any promises about world domination. As long as I don't run out of constructive activities, the rest of you may be safe. I suspect the saying, Jack of all trades, master of none, is very ancient. Probably at least as old as the divine right of kings concept. When other members of the tribe are good at taking care of themselves, who really needs a self-centered, bossy leader? Dividing societies into hierarchies based on status is the easiest way to maintain one's position at the top. Do you recall how status is assigned? You should. We already discussed this topic in episode 4, What Does It Mean to Live? Civilizations were founded on this principle and could only survive long-term in that form, as long as generations of people were locked into a single skill or none at all. When you discredit the desire to master multiple disciplines, you effectively destroy someone's ability to become upwardly mobile. I sense a few of you are about to open your mouths, ready to point out, as a half-Libra, I happen to like nice things. Perhaps. Thanks to some of my hoity-toity ancestors, heredity might play a role too. Although I don't mind getting a bit of dirt under my nails in order to obtain my desires. I did own 2 English Angora rabbits, who produce a silky soft luxury fiber. The stuff is highly practical, because it's very warm and a little goes a long way. I worked for every ounce now lurking in my stash, with daily cage cleaning, feeding the critters at least 3 times a day, lots of brushing to prevent tangles and death by woolblock, then harvesting the wool every 3 months. Those rabbits, whom I had no plans to own until 2 years before my mom died, ultimately provided something far more profound. They were reverse emotional therapy animals, who forced me to calm myself before I could do anything with them. Even now, the 2 bunnies I still have continue serving in that capacity. Sadly, my honey bunny Angus is definitely showing his age now. Hardly surprising, since he's 11. That's 3 to 4 years past the lifespan of any rabbits, and it's particularly unusual for the Angora breeds. I lost 3 pets in 2020, 2 rabbits and 1 dog. My first bunny, Mr. Harry Buns, was 7. My other EA, Lola Rapunzel, didn't quite reach 6 years. This may be the year I need to let Angus go, but like everything else in life, we take it one day at a time. He still has a healthy appetite, and I do my best to keep him comfortable. All my pets have left me with valuable memories, and because Angus and Lola were very extra, they left a special legacy which I can enjoy for years to come and also give to others. For those of you who keep coming back, hoping you'll find the yellow brick road to the Emerald City of Writing Nirvana, I will try not to disappoint here. Naturally, as a parent, I do feel a responsibility to remind my hopeful Dorothys, there are no magical shortcuts from Munchkin Land to you-know-where. Poppies that make you sleepy, flying monkeys with an attitude. Need I go on? Remember, to not only find inspiration, but also something to put into those stories, you have to live. Pay attention to everything along the road. The good, the bad, the small, the big. Engage all your wonderful senses every moment you're awake. Hearing, sight, taste, feel. Take a moment to savor or analyze and apply a few words, especially new ones, to your experiences, even the bad ones. Never fear learning new things and mastering any which spark excitement. If someone tells you it's not cool to be a know-it-all or overachiever, do yourself a favor by remembering the human species is fundamentally lazy. Also remember, storytellers who write what they know are not only able to write with confidence, but from a position of authority. Knowledge and skills together are power. They're both rather worthless on their own. I can provide an example from my first book, Heart of a Star. My heroine Isabel knits, just like I do, and makes a mistake on her project because she allowed her mind to wander. A lace project. I've been knitting since the age of 19 and am now in my 50s. Plenty of time to try different kinds of knitting techniques, including lace. I know from experience, one does not rip out. Also known as frogging, a row or two when you make a mistake with lace. First of all, yes, you do need to correct it, otherwise it's likely to mess up a pattern you worked hard to establish in the first place. Making holes in lace involves an increase called a yarn over, and returning to the original stitch count requires making some decreases, all within the same row. For the non-knitters, trust me when I say ripping out lace will make you sadder than when you first found the mistake. Why? Because you have to remove the needle holding all those tricky stitches to unravel a project. The best course of action, especially for experienced knitters, is not to do ripping of any kind on any project, regardless of the type. There's always a high probability you will miss a stitch when putting the work back on one of the needles. Then you have a drop stitch. They're a hassle to fix if you fail to catch it immediately. Instead, the best course of action, though a bit slower, is to unknit until you reach the mistake. My actual experience with this craft allowed me to use it effortlessly as a story element. All readers will relate to something in this brief scene, especially the tactile pleasure of handling something very soft. Many might receive a bonus pit in their stomach. Who doesn't get those when they realize they've made a mistake? Another knitter will discover a delightful Easter egg in a character who happens to share an interest with them. Let's be honest here. Everyone reading this story, regardless of their other interests, are there for the central romance. Those who don't knit aren't being distracted from the story by someone who's trying to prove they did their research. Please don't misunderstand the main point. Experience, imagination, and research are all important tools in my writing chest. The trick is to use them in small doses and weave them in subtly. Think sparkly accent in the cloth of your story. If you conclude being extra doesn't suit you, don't worry. We're still good. However, you might surprise yourself when you realize you're already extra. Getting up each morning, especially after a difficult day, and finding a reason to keep going is a form of extra. So is making a deliberate choice to be kind and considerate to every person you encounter throughout your day. Take it from me. This is one skill even an introvert can manage. Like all steps taken to achieve new growth, the best place to start is always by flipping one's attitude from negative to positive. It's not just an investment you're making in yourself. Don't underestimate how your efforts to be the right type of extra might benefit others. You are listening to Season 1 of Tea with Crystal. This is Episode 9, To Be or Not to Be, Extra. Narrated by Crystal Rady Young and produced by Harry Buns Productions, exclusively for the Purple Prose Room. Copyright 2021.